You would patiently bear, you know, this problem, and you wouldn't be so intensely sad about it. In continuation, the Imam says, for your affliction at having neglected preparation for it, meaning the hereafter, is much greater than the loss of your son. Your son has passed away, it's true. His spirit has gone to God, and he is in a peaceful and in a very happy state, right? But by grieving in such a manner and not being patient, right, you are harming your akhirat, your hereafter, and what will befall you in after death. In a similar manner, in another tradition, Imam Ali alayhi salam says the following. The Imam was once asked what the worst affliction was, to which he replied, to be afflicted with a blow to one's faith, meaning to having having one's iman decrease. It's very interesting, in the night in which the Prophet migrated from Mecca to Medina, the Prophet, Laylatul Mabit, as they call it in Arabic, the Prophet came to, you know, the story is that the Prophet came to Imam Ali alayhi salam and asked him to sleep in his bed, because there was a plan to kill the Prophet on this night. The plan was that the Prophet would be killed. The Prophet said, the Prophet made a plan that for Imam Ali to sleep in his bed, and he would secretly escape. The Imam alayhi salam, when was asked by the Prophet, he simply said, if sleeping in this bed will save you, I will surely do it. The Imam was thinking about his faith and not about his life. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the worst of afflictions and the reward for enduring an affliction in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Ukraine war is moving full steam ahead. Russia has not only targeted weapons provided by the U.S. and its NATO allies, it has hit the capital, Kyiv. In another major escalation, Putin says that Russia will hit fresh targets if U.S. delivers long-range rockets. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the military might of either side will decide when this war will end, while questioning what a win would look like in the first place.
Tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine war are entering a new stage, as Washington and its allies in Europe continue to send military equipment to Kyiv. The U.S.'s new plan to send long-range missiles to Ukraine has sparked a stark warning from Russia.
If they supply Ukraine with long-range missiles, we will draw the appropriate conclusions and use our weapons, of which we have enough, to strike targets we haven't yet hit.
Putin said Moscow is destroying U.S. weapons sent to Ukraine by the dozen. He said Russia is easily coping and targeting the shipments. Putin said the sole aim of the West supplying arms to Ukraine was to prolong the conflict for as long as possible. His warning was echoed by the Russian foreign minister. Sergei Lavrov warned the supply of advanced missile systems to Ukraine raises the risk of a third country getting dragged into the conflict.
The things that the Kyiv regime unapologetically demands from its Western patrons, firstly overstep all bounds of decency and diplomatic relations, and secondly are a direct provocation aimed at drawing the West into combat.
On Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden agreed to provide Ukraine with HIMARS multiple launch rocket systems as part of a $700 million weapons package.
The capabilities in this package include high mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS, and guided munitions with a range of up to 70 kilometers, 5 counterartillery radars, 2 air surveillance radars, 1,000 additional javelins and 50 command launch units, 6,000 anti-armor weapons, 15,000 155-millimeter artillery rounds.
HIMARS is a mobile unit capable of simultaneously launching multiple precision-guided missiles up to 80 kilometers away. Since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Washington has approved 11 military assistance packages for Ukraine. The biggest was last month and worth $40 billion. European countries have also followed suit. Aside from that, the United States has provided intelligence that helped Ukrainians locate and strike Russian targets. But where does the line between supporting an ally and actively participating in the conflict lie? Many believe that gray zone is getting dangerously blurred. One wrong political move and the fighting in Ukraine could quickly become a war between Russia and NATO.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Don DeBar joins us. He's a journalist and activist from Westchester, New York. Also joining us is Cindy Sheehan, who's an anti-war activist who joins us from Sacramento.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Don DeBar, let me first start with you. We're looking at the most recent development here, and that is how Russia has launched this airstrike into Kyiv for the first time. Now, Russia has said that it has destroyed what it says was Western-supplied tanks and other armored vehicles, and the position that it targeted was actually on the outskirts of Kyiv, and these were supplies that were provided by U.S. and the European countries. Let's first look at that aspect of it, because it's the first time that this has happened, and that's the reason that Russia has given. Russia has stated that it's going to target weapons provided by either the U.S. and or NATO members, but is it also sending a message that it can target Kyiv?
Not only Kyiv, by the way. But Kyiv is, we said it for, I don't know, the last 100 years. Just to remind people that Russia said that, you know, they could not come forward into Ukraine, that Russia would not allow it, and everyone ignored it, and they had the coup, and they shelled Donbass for 8 years, and they mobilized to go in and finish off Donbass, and the Russians came in and stopped them, and they've acquired essentially eastern Ukraine. It's certainly behind the lines now. They can choose to, at will, pretty much keep it. Crimea is off the table as far as any realistic person is concerned. And they have the ability to, rather easily, if they'd like to, either level Kyiv, they could do that pushing two or three buttons, or to take it, just to starve it and take it. And also Lviv, by the way, or Lviv, depending on your preference. And I think that you have to take seriously what they've done here after saying what they would do. when you consider Finland and Sweden joining NATO, because Finland will be facing a similar situation, finally. Not only can they strike Kiev at will, and people are surprised at that, it may be a fiction that everyone else in the United States buys, and some of the European public, that the United States and NATO are not at war with Russia, but rather Russia and Kiev are duking it out and we're helping an ally. Russian strategic planners and most serious adults on the planet realize, in fact, that's a lot of nonsense. That Russia and the United States are at war right now in Ukraine, and at some point in time, if the United States reaches into Russia deeply enough, Russia is going to reach into the United States. First, maybe you'll see Warsaw or perhaps even Berlin get a taste of that kind of a, you know, response. But they are perfectly capable of taking out New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, et cetera, if it gets there. And
Okay. They
have said, look, that's what we'll do if that's where it goes. And yet, the U.S. is going there, it seems.
That's a very fine point that that Don DeBar is making there, Cindy Sheehan, in terms of the warnings that Russia has given. I mean, from the year, well, I was about to say 2014 when the war started, really, but even prior to that in terms of NATO's eastward expansion. So you can see how long Russia has waited. And now we're looking at the numerous times that Russia is issuing warnings after warning after warning that it's going to target U.S. and NATO's supplies. And here it has done so in Kyiv. The point here is why isn't the U.S. and NATO members taking that warning seriously, and or is that because they want this war to to continue, to prolong, so to speak?
Well, excuse me. I thank you for inviting me again, but I don't think that the United States and its NATO allies and, you know, other countries want this war to end. Actually, I think that the profiteering is a huge factor in this. You know, if the United States is the biggest arms manufacturer and weapons dealer in the entire world, so how can the U.S. sell its arms and weapons if there aren't any wars? So I think that Putin and Russia have been very, you know, patient. They were actually very patient for at least these 8 years, like you said, and like Don was saying, how the West and Ukraine has tried to provoke, and NATO has tried to provoke Russia into this situation. And it reminds me of the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 1962 when I was only 5 years old. I know it's hard to imagine that I was ever that young, but I remember how it was the major topic and how all the adults around me were so nervous and worried and upset. And here in the United States, it just seems to be like, you know, the people here in the U.S. are blithely or blandly or whatever, watching the U.S. provoke Russia into nuclear annihilation, which has been a real nightmare, you know, ever since I was born, ever since the U.S. dropped 2 atomic bombs on Japan. And so it's very despicable that anybody would want to profit off of this killing, the potential annihilation of life on the planet. And, you know, it just is, it just shows to what lengths that these people will go to for their profit. And it almost seems like this horrible James Bond movie for world domination. You know, it's scary.
Sure.
To be adult in this time, seeing these things, just thinking, is there a future for my children and grandchildren? And it's really not a topic of conversation. The topic is support Ukraine. And if you don't support Ukraine, that means you must be a Trump supporter. It's just really crazy. It's just super crazy here. I think Don would verify that.
Well, let's talk about Americans then, since you're talking about it right now. Don DeBar. I couldn't help but looking at one of the sound bites of an American in California at a particular gas station who was pumping her BMW SUV, saying that we got to stand with Ukraine because even though the gas prices are so high. So the reason why, I mean, that's one side of the story. The other side are the general public. The general public is watching. The last time around, we had, what, $700 million of military aid that the U.S., I guess, got approved. And I'm not too sure if you're a fan of Senator Rand Paul, but I'm going to quote him. No matter how sympathetic the cause, my oath of office is to the national security of the U.S. And, of course, saying that here we have, you know, all this money going towards Ukraine when the Americans could use it. They could use it in many ways. So is that an aspect that the U.S. president looks at and says, it's okay, we got to go with Ukraine?
Well, the U.S. president looks at his teleprompter and he says whatever it tells him to say. I think that's widely known around the planet now. You know, first of all, what Cindy said is absolutely true. This is like whatever else it is. It is also a massive exercise in profiteering. Now, you know, the $700 million that you just referenced is the most recent tranche, but it was a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, they approved almost unanimously in the two houses of Congress $40 billion to Ukraine, and that was the second tranche this year. There was 13.6 before that. The $40 billion is intended to cover a five-month period to basically fund the war for 5 months. Now, annualized $40 billion for 5 months is $100 billion for a year. And at $100 billion a year, you are almost 50% over the annual military budget of Russia. Only Russia's $65 million a year military budget provides for a military to fight a war in the Baltics, if need be, in Ukraine, if need be, in Poland, if need be, in the Sea of Japan, if need be, and in the off the Korean Peninsula. In other words, the expanse of about a sixth of the surface area of the planet. Russia defends itself with $65 billion. At just this crunch point in Ukraine, we're throwing in the equivalent of $100 billion. Does not include the UK, France, Germany, Italy, Poland, and the rest. That's the first part. The second part is if you look at how much money that actually is, okay, the total housing budget of the federal government, the Department of Housing and Urban Development annually is about $45 billion. Now we have millions of people in foreclosure, millions of people in eviction, hundreds of thousands to millions in the streets, and the condition is deteriorating, and yet we are giving enough to double our budget to Ukraine to cover 5 months worth of war with Russia at Russia's borders. You know, it's insane.
You know, it's interesting. Let me get your idea. Since you mentioned about how the money that's given so far by the U.S. Actually is almost the entire defense budget of Russia.
So
if you put the two together, then they are spending that much. They should have made more advances, they meaning the U.S. and its NATO countries, compared to Russia. We're going to talk about the narrative, but am I correct to look at it that way?
I think so. You know, okay. I think that, first of all, if you take a look at what they actually get for that, you know, first of all, if you're going to buy armaments, you need to have an army. I mean, the population of Ukraine is less than a third of the population of Russia.
Right.
Half, or at least a third, their actual loyalty is to Russia. They're Russians. Also, the group that is in charge of Ukraine, the Nazis that are there, they're a distinct minority among the population. That's always how Nazis rule, by the way. They're brought to power by the rich, because that's whose interests they serve. And they get a group of people who are very desperate, excited, and make them crazy and intimidate the rest of the population. But you can't field an army with that,
right?
Unless you have the numbers, and they don't.
We have to talk about that. We have to talk about the foreign, I don't know what you want to call them. The Department of Homeland Security called them American white nationalists. My question to Cindy Sheehan. According to a report that was released by the DHS, U.S. fascists are fighting in Ukraine. American white nationalists with documented histories of violence are obtaining combat experience with advanced U.S.-made weapons. Now, the focus of this release was not so much about Ukraine, But the fact that the DHS is worried that these American fascist white nationalists, whatever you want to call them, are going to come back to the States and they're going to be radicalized. That was the gist I got from the article. But the fact that they're there and the fact that you have, according to the DHS, there are these white nationalists or fascists that include violent extremists that are actually being recruited at embassy in Washington, D.C. and consulates across the U.S. sheds another light. First of all, do you think that that's true? I mean, I'm assuming it is. The DHS came out. But, I mean, that right. really puts things into a different perspective when it comes to this particular segment who's in the war in Ukraine.
It's news to me, but I am having some echo. I have echo when I talk. Anyway, it's I don't know if that's true, but they're going to fight with the Azov Battalion, the Nazis in Ukraine. Is that what the
It says, Cindy Sheehan, it says that the Department of Homeland Security, which has been gathering intelligence on Americans who have joined the ranks of more than 20,000 foreign volunteers. I'm assuming they are going to be fighting within or with the members of the Azov Battalion, which Azov Movement, who are actively recruiting either ethnically motivated or violent extremists or these types of characters, which the U.S., with the participation of the U.S. It's hard to verify all of this. I can't argue against the DHS, you see, because it's not something that's covered so much by media outlets or by online news organizations.
Well, of course, we have to give anything that comes out of the U.S. government, we have to treat it with a grain of salt, and we have to try to verify it from independent sources. But, you know, we do know that many, these people who wanted to go fight in a war, Americans went to Ukraine to sign up to fight against Russia. And we've seen from these same Americans who escaped from the Ukraine that they were put in these situations with guns that had very few bullets. They were essentially being used as human shields, and they had their passports taken away from them when they got there. So they had to sneak across the border into Poland, you know, using organizations like the American Red Cross to help them get over the border. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if it is true, but it's certainly not like the communists and socialists who joined to go fight against fascism in Spain in the 1930s. Sure. You know, it certainly is a different cause, but we see, it's hard because we see here in the United States, we see people of all political stripes supporting the government in Kiev that has been sympathetic to Nazi elements. So we have widespread support for that here in the United States.
Don DeBar, I got to get your opinion on this also. First of all, the whole Azov movement, if you want to call it that, the Azov Battalion, and also the fact that the DHS has come out and saying that you have these white supremacists or white nationalists from the U.S. who are there fighting. What do you think?
Right. Well, yes, there are that. You know, I've spoken with Ava Bartlett and some others on the ground there, and in fact, that's true. Also, some have been captured, and some have come out. And what Cindy said is correct, that you know, they've been lose their passports, and they're trapped in there. Once they get a body in there, they said that we're cannon fodder. These are Americans. The DHS sentiment, or whatever they're expressing in this memorandum, certainly it's a valid point. If you look at Al Qaeda and 9/11, for example, the blowback thing. I'm not so sure that this is, you know, an anti-policy of the government. In other words, I'm not so sure DHS is really concerned about it, and in fact, perhaps they're actually cultivating these, you know, these things. But I would like to point out, maybe 4 years ago, having conversations, you know, with folks here on Press TV and elsewhere, when shortly after Trump took office. In some schools, for example, somebody drew a swastika on a piece of toilet paper or, you know, on a chalkboard, said, you know, some slur or whatever that indicated that they were ultra-nationalist, right-wing Nazi types. And the whole country went bananas over this stuff. It was an indication that Trump was a Nazi and anyone who uttered his name without vomiting was a Nazi or whatever. And we have Biden here. First, we have Obama and Biden and Clinton installing Nazis in control of Ukraine back in 2014, actively, I mean, even on the telephone with Vicky Nuland. And now we have Biden arming and training and, you know, ready to go to World War III with Nazis, on behalf of Nazis, hiring the Nazis, in essence, and nobody's saying a word about it. In fact, if you point it out in social media, you get deplatformed for a while. You know, that we are in bed, to the extent that these people are really Nazis and not like crisis actors, we're in bed with Nazis completely, like, you know, with the covers over our heads. And that should be of concern to people here, whether they come back here or not, because it means the Nazis are already in control of the U.S. government here. We don't have to worry about some knuckleheads coming back with rifle skills and taking over the country. They're already in charge.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Well, we're quickly running out of time over here. I'm not too sure how to go about my last question, but Cindy Sheehan, what I'm looking at over here are the issue of sanctions against Russia. I mean, it is widely believed that it's not having the effect, the ultimate effect that the U.S. and its European allies wanted. I mean, the Europeans especially couldn't even have a unified stance when it comes to purchases of Russian oil and gas. I mean, oil they can maybe replace, but gas they can't. And they had to exempt some of the EU member countries from that. Well, that means that Russia is going to still continue generating revenue. So, and of course, we're looking at inflation, and we're looking at all the different consequences that's impacting all the countries across the world, really, but in particular the U.S. and the EU suffering from over 8% inflation. How much longer do you think that the U.S. and the European allies, NATO members in particular, are going to go after this war?
Well, what we need to understand here is the United States has had sanction regime for decades. They have embargoed Cuba. And so the U.S. uses sanctions to hurt, as you know, anybody in Iran knows, to hurt the people of the country. And what we're seeing here with the sanctions against Russia is that they're backfiring, and the chickens are essentially coming home to roost because the sanctions are causing more inflation and, you know, hyperinflation and problems here in the United States.
Thank you. Don DeBar, journalist and activist from Westchester, New York. Cindy Sheehan, thank you so much. Anti-war activist from Sacramento. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider, bringing you Back to Reality. Here in the studio today, we have with us dear sister Zainab Sadat. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And our dear brother, Sheikh Yasir Ibrahim, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Now, obviously, faith is a central part of Islam. Alladhina amanu wa amilu salihat, those who believe and do good deeds. This phrase is repeated so often throughout the Quranic literature, the tafasir, and even in the Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam's words. We know that these two things, belief and good deeds, are incredibly, incredibly important. But we're going to be focusing on the first part of that, this idea of iman. Why is it so important? I mean, I can give charity, I can be a good person to others. Why do I have to have this belief? I'd like to go first to Sheikh Ibrahim.
It's a very important question. Again, it's a theological question. I don't want to bore the listeners with my theological rants. But why is belief important? Just be, like you mentioned, be a good person. You know, one of the things that belief gives you is a kind of border, right? Like, for example, everybody has belief. First of all, that's something to get in there. Nobody can say, I have no belief. Having no belief itself is a belief. Right?
Yeah.
So whatever your belief may be, you act according to it. It's a manifestation. Your actions are manifestation of what you have inside of you.
It's like when somebody says, I have no politics.
Exactly, and that's itself is a political stance, right? It's a
political stance.
The same thing. Yeah. The belief that you have, again, how you get that belief, how you've ended up coming to that particular conclusion that this is what I believe in. I believe in aliens, for example, and aliens are going to come and induct me or whatever you want to do. You have gone through a particular journey to reach that particular conclusion. And then you will act with the world around you based on those beliefs, right? So first of all, principally, the beliefs or your actions rather are a manifestation of your beliefs. So therefore, they are important, regardless whether you like it or not. Interacting with other people, therefore, are also based on your beliefs. Further, the reason why you interact with people, your intentions are based on your beliefs. The intention, the actual intention. That you
right.
So it whole spectrum of things. So it is important for a person to clearly identify, what do I believe in?
Mm.
In order to understand, okay, well, this is why I'm acting in a particular manner. Or this is why I shouldn't act in a particular manner. Like, for example, in Western society, or in majority of societies throughout the world, people don't commit crime not because, oh, I'm being watched by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there's a CCTV camera watching.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The big difference, right? Remove the camera.
To quote the Joker, when the chips are down, these civilized people, they will eat each other.
Proper.
You know, because when the electricity goes, for example, the CCTV cameras are switched off, now all hell breaks loose. It's a good point. So your beliefs directly impact your actions.
We'll come right back to that, inshallah, after a break.
Sister, what are your immediate thoughts on this idea of faith being so important?
Well, I personally believe that faith is somehow a pillar to a person. It is considered as the pillar of a person, the base of a person. When I have a good thoughts, when I have good beliefs about here in religion, about God, for example, I will not be influenced by anything or any person at all, you know. In case I don't have a much strong belief, in case I'm just imitating my parents, for example, in doing religious conducts, then somebody comes to me and tells me that, okay, Zainab, you don't have to bother yourself. Mm. You can just eat your food when you're alone. And when you come to your parents, you can pretend to be fasting. Mm. Or you can pretend to say your prayers in front of them and lots of things. But, you know, when it comes to me and I have a good belief or faith, I would say no. I would say strongly no.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe that God watches me. And I believe that fasting is good for my health. It's good for my own. I do not want to cheat others. I cannot cheat myself. And that's the case. So it's quite important for everyone to work on their beliefs or to work on their faith, because it shows lots of things and it determines your destiny and your and even your relationship to God.
Right. Okay, so what I'm getting from both of you here is that faith is important because it influences your actions, right? I am a decent human being. And some of them, you know, in action-wise, they are. You know, they even if the lights were switched off, per se, a certain person, they wouldn't commit any crimes. They wouldn't be dishonest. They wouldn't steal anything. They wouldn't kill anybody, right? Even though they don't have any faith at all in, like, a higher power. So what do you have to say about that?
That particular passage, obviously we cannot look at specifics. Looking at specifics would obviously be detrimental. We have to understand that, okay, is my faith important, or is there a particular faith that I have to accept that will make all of this worthy?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, otherwise it would just be like so one for example, after right? Action.
For example, people ask questions that Thomas Edison, like today,
the light bulb, the
microphone we're using, the lights we're in, our laptops, our phones, everything is based off that one discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Like so much good is done from it. What happened to this person? But we do not know Thomas Edison, the person. We don't know what he did. We don't know what he may have done, other things in his private life. He's, you know, we don't know. We know nothing. History doesn't tell us anything. So we can't make specifics about these people. We don't know what's in a person's heart.
Hmm.
We don't know the intentions of that person. Which comes back to a more important thing. Like I mentioned as well, the concept of intention. We have, again, the concept of faith. The intention by which the action is done is also important.
Hmm.
Do I do that action in order to become famous?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where you find a difference. For example, one of the great scholars of Islam, Shaykh Mutahhari, rahmatullah alayhi, writes in one of his books that there was a time when nobody would work in a certain hospital in Iran. And a group of Christians from the Europe came. So he said, look, not to be pessimistic and not to be negative, but let's look at why they came. Did they come purely out of altruism, just to come and serve, or was there something behind them? This is something we need to look at. The intention here is important.
They were being paid. Yeah. A lot of
or
money.
Pay or whatever it was, right? So is the act itself important or no? Is the intention behind that act also important? And belief forms that intention.
So are we saying that a person who doesn't have the faith but has the action is actually in some ways insincere in what they do?
Depending on what they're looking at. Why are you doing it? And one of the beauties of this world is that you will never know a person's intention.
It's not a beautiful thing, is it? It's a little bit frustrating. Let's come back to Sister. You said a very adamant yes threat there.
Yes, and you know, another thing that sets an atheist person or a person who does not have any belief in God with a person who is Muslim or believes in God is the criteria that are set by God, and we have to follow them. I accepted that our instincts tell us what to do, and definitely a good thing is considered as a good thing for all the religions. For example,
to an
extent. Yes, for example, you know, being kind, it is considered as a good thing for everybody. And coming to Islam, God has set some criteria for being good, for treating other people in a good way. And there are several narrations, there are several verses, and I think that we don't have much time. In general, I want to say that the criteria that are set by our God, Allah, or by Islam, make it different for us to act from those who do not believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's it.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Al-a'mal bin niyat, that your actions are based on your intention. But then the imam goes, wa hu al-amal, that the intention itself is the act. The imam goes deeper. He doesn't say that your actions are based on your intention. The imam stops and says, no. Mm. Think about it. Your act, the intention itself is your act.
That is subhanallah.
And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam mentioned this tradition, that the intention itself is the actual manifestation of the act, and the output of that intention of yours is what you see in the physical.
So when it comes to the... if actions are on niyat, on the intentions, right? So actions matter only according to what the intention behind them was. That's what we're essentially saying here. And if the imam is actually defining the intention itself, to make an intention is a verb. It is a action that we're taking. What's the niyyah behind that?
That is goes back to irada. It goes back to will.
Goes back to what?
Will. The will of the soul.
We're talking about, you know, as'alukum ala ruh. Like, they ask you concerning the ruh. And then Allah replies, well, he tells the Prophet to say, قول الروح
من أمر الله من أمر ربك
أمر ربك من أمر ربي. So that's really deeply philosophical, isn't it? Because that means that your action of having an intention, the intention behind that action is God.
God is the reason why we're doing. Intention could be somehow regarded as the reason for why you're doing something.
This is where you see the difference. The concept of ruh and nafs is very difficult. But there are certain faculties within the nafs. Each of these faculties manifests a certain thing. Your nafs can have an intention that can be satanic, and it can be divine. So you see the intention, wherever it flows from, will manifest itself very differently. Even though in the physical manner it may be the same in terms of its outward appearance, but its source is very different. For example, a person like, let's mention his name, Mr. Musk, may give charity, but for a very devilish intention. Give a lot of money, but for a very devilish intention. Whereas me or you give not even a 0.001% of that same thing. And there's a very famous thing about the khums. I don't know if you remember the story of the khums.
If you can throw it in there very quickly.
I can't remember which imam it was. I think it was Imam Kazim alayhi salam, if I'm not mistaken, that all of his Shia from all over, I think it was from Khorasan, give khums. Imam said, take all of his back. There's one coin. Give me that coin. One coin. Why? He said, this was done with ikhlas. The rest was not. From a lady who gave one coin.
That's all we have time for, unfortunately. I wish we could discuss this in more detail. From myself, from Sister Zainab Sadat, and from Brother Yasser Ibrahim, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
We're on our way to the front line, outside the key Ukrainian stronghold of Adievka. We pull up by the side of the road. It feels like no man's land.
The town is fortified well, but we're working on them, dismantling their dugouts with artillery. We're making passages in their defenses and going deeper. You can hear our volleys now.
Now, it's too dangerous to take the car along this road, as it can be a target for anti-tank missiles fired from the Ukrainians, who are just about a kilometer in that direction, so we're going on foot.
These fighters are from the Donbas, now loyal to Russia. They've been fighting here against Ukrainian nationalists for 8 years. Trench warfare has returned once again to Europe. While some of the world's most advanced weapons are slaughtering dozens of soldiers every day, the best defense remains underground. The living quarters, it's infested with kittens. The soldiers tell me that they have them at every outpost. They bring good luck, they say. More likely, much needed comfort in this brutal war.
Now, Adievka is just over in that direction there. It's so well fortified that risking a frontal attack would cost so many lives, or indeed may not even be possible. That's why the Russian army is trying to encircle the Ukrainian army to the north of here. And then, after it does that, if it's able to do that, they plan to come down here and take Adievka. Because to take Donbass, the whole of Donbass, it's major fortifications like this, which will have to be taken as well.
The remains of mortar shells. The trenches are doing their job. It's been some time since Russia has released its casualty figures, perhaps because the number might be hard for Russian people to swallow. But it's clear, with overwhelming air and artillery superiority, Russia is winning this war, where the fighting is fiercest. The next outpost, as promised, more kittens. Russian soldiers are being dehumanized by Ukrainian propaganda as monsters and orcs, leading to atrocities committed against Russian POWs. But it's clear these soldiers are very human indeed. Upon hearing I was British, one of the soldiers appealed to me to tell the truth about what was happening here to people back in the UK. I asked him what that truth was.
That there's a genocide of the Russian-speaking population going on here. The Ukrainians have been shelling our people for 8 years. They are trying to extinguish us. Tell them about this at least. At any moment, I can die here. But I am on my land and I will fight for it.
No doubt the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches across the fields will have a very different version of the truth. Compromise is being achieved through war. Appropriately for this European conflict, poppies grow in the trenches. Many years from now, perhaps soldiers from both sides will be able to commemorate their fallen comrades together. But for now, the battle for the Donbass rages on. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
Okay.
The majority of the EU's 705 legislators do support the 27-nation bloc's handling of the Ukraine conflict, but a growing minority are very unhappy. On the issue of sanctions, the EU has been accused of double standards and hypocrisy.
If Russia attacks Ukraine, there will be sanctions. When the US bombs Iraq, no sanctions. When Saudi Arabia bombs Yemen, no sanctions. When the EU destroys Libya, no sanctions. When Israel colonizes Palestine, no sanctions.
When dissenting voices in the European Parliament highlight Ukraine's history of corruption or the need for greater diplomatic efforts with Russia, they are often shut down.
Please, dear colleagues, try to do preventive diplomacy. As somebody who has gone through
you
the
have
war,
to come to
I know that war does not resolve anything. Thank you.
Mainly due to the conflict, energy and food prices continue to soar in the EU, placing enormous financial hardship on citizens. Despite this, it seems the focus remains fixed on weapons.
Our unprecedented military support package of 2 billion euros under the European peace facility helps Ukraine defend its population.
Some analysts blame NATO and the EU, directed by the United States, for provoking Russia into military action.
And now, for Ukraine, it's a very bad situation. For Russia also, and for Europe, it's a very bad situation.
Any of the 27 leaders in the EU can veto key policies in the European Council. For example, Hungary has been blocking a total ban on Russian oil imports. Some lawmakers want the veto option to be scrapped.
For 1 month, we put our indecisiveness out on full display. And what was the outcome? The perception that one member state won and the EU as a collective lost.
Other lawmakers disagree. They say it would be yet another example of the EU moving away from being a peace project and towards becoming a federalist superpower to benefit big business, including the arms industry. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
The UK has marked the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The royal family paraded the capital over the long bank holiday weekend, and Transport for London finally opened the long-awaited Elizabeth line. But strikes put a damper on things, with members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, desperate for better pay, walked off the job. Rose works for TfL. After a long day on the picket line, she spoke at the People's Assembly. The cost of living crisis has hit hard, but who will bear the brunt?
This is affecting all working people of all different types in all parts of the country. And that means that we do have to come together. We do need to recognise that we are in this fight together.
The government must act. It must act to make sure that children aren't hungry. It must act to make sure that people don't lose their homes. It must act so that people can go on holiday. That's an important thing as well. And we're going to lose all of that across the next few months unless the government changes course.
The speakers insisted the key to success was unity. Massive rallies are being planned, and people from a myriad of causes will be attending.
We're in a situation now where in the most serious cost of living crisis, the most serious attack on working people that there's been for generations, our government is considering increasing what is already a massive defence budget, a massive arms spending budget. And that seems to us to be completely absurd and actually disgraceful.
The speakers here today warned that dire poverty is knocking on the doors of millions of people across the UK, and the government has no intention of intervening. Record price hikes have already happened, and more is just around the corner. Food, fuel, energy bills, mortgage premiums, national insurance contributions and tuition fees. You name it, the price has gone up. Politicians are blaming the UK's predicament on external factors.
But Mr. Speaker, the war's most significant impact domestically is on the cost of living. COVID and global factors meant goods and energy prices were already high. Statistics published this morning show that inflation in February was 6.2%.
But during the same period, energy companies have reported record profits. City bonuses have gone up six times wages, and politicians have made it to the UK's rich list. Households have been promised a few hundred pounds in relief, but it won't even scratch the surface, as millions of families wonder where their next meal is coming from. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With unions showing rare unity, hospitals were brought to a near halt across France due to a major strike. Since the Great Recession began, seemingly no group in France, other than the Yellow Vests, have protested more often than medical workers. France's healthcare system was ranked number one in the world as recently as the year 2000 by the United Nations. However, its quality has plummeted following over a decade of banker bailouts and austerity cuts. Neoliberal economics as applied to public healthcare has created too many complaints by medical workers to list. Frozen salaries, slashed budgets, overwork, closed hospitals, a lack of equipment, gutted morale, and much more. Thousands of medical workers who refused orders to get coronavirus vaccines haven't been reintegrated, even though corona restrictions have ended in France. And that has created even more labor problems.
When you don't replace workers who retire or quit, then you're going to have longer wait times for critical medical care and worsened medical care overall. It's just gotten harder and harder to work at a hospital every year. We now have so few personnel that it feels like every single day is a strike day.
The degraded service has been dramatic and a common topic across France for years. The healthcare system is used by everybody, so politicians haven't been able to limit the negative impact to just the lower classes.
After 5 years of Macron, our healthcare system is in a state of catastrophe. We're seeing more and more people die from a lack of treatment. We have the money inside France already. Just tax the rich and businesses. Go after tax evasion and stop focusing public policy on the richest 20% of society. If we do that, then we'll have good public services and good healthcare.
The first round of legislative elections are less than a week away. The strike is a black eye for President Emmanuel Macron, just as he's trying to preserve his absolute majority in Parliament, which is crucial for him to be able to force through more neoliberal austerity measures. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Palestinians protested in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the 55th anniversary of Nakba Day, meaning the Day of Setback. Nakba Day refers to the defeat of Arab armies in the 1967 war, which saw Israel's complete occupation of Palestine and Al-Quds, as well as the displacement and disposition of more Palestinians. In recent weeks, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. During a press conference, Palestinian resistance factions vowed to continue on their path of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The criminal Zionist enemy must understand that the Palestinian people will always protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian people will sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Quds. Aggression against Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds will only happen over the dead bodies of Palestinians.
Nakba Day came just 19 days after Nakba Day of 1948, which saw the forceful displacement and disposition of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
As we mark the 55th anniversary of the Zionist aggression of 1967, we assert that we will continue to fight for the sake of liberating Al-Quds, the eternal capital of Palestine. There is no such thing as Zionist sovereignty over Al-Quds or over Palestine. Al-Quds, Al-Aqsa, and Palestine belong to the Palestinian people.
Decades on, Palestinians have been trying to liberate their occupied lands by all forms of resistance.
As they mark the 55th anniversary of Nakba Day, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of their land. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In a new report aimed at highlighting hunger hotspots, the UN bodies warned that Afghanistan is the new entry to the list of countries at highest alert, facing catastrophic conditions. The report says, beside other causes, the ripple effects of the war in Ukraine, including rising prices, are adding to the difficulties of people to provide food.
Today, food prices are skyrocketing globally due to war in Ukraine and wheat and food exports crisis. Afghanistan, as an importing and dependent country, has received major impacts. Since we don't receive imported food or goods, we witness a quick rise in prices and food scarcity. Now the prices of food items are doubled and few people can afford them.
At the same time, Afghan middle-class families are sliding into poverty and hunger, as unemployment has been on the rise. Some also say that they are struggling to make ends meet.
Unemployment and poverty have severely increased. Not only me, but all of the people have a slight